I'm going to begin with one of my favorite quotes from St. Augustine, because I think it's going to have everything to do with our session this morning and all the way through. Let me get this off here. I'm going to sleep a little bit, and then we'll come back. Okay. Here's the quote. It's from the Confessions, Book 10, Chapter 6, Paragraph 8. 10, 6, 8. Here's St. Augustine praying to God as the whole of the Confessions, this artful prayer that he composes, but also is wrestling with God all the way through. When I love you, what do I love? Not the body's beauty, nor time's rhythm, nor light's brightness, nor song's sweet melodies, nor the fragrance of flowers, lotions, and spices, nor manna and honey, nor the feel of flesh embracing flesh. None of these are what I love when I love my God. And yet, it's something like light, sound, smell, food, and touch that I love when I love my God. The light, the voice, the food, the fragrance, the embrace of self, where a light shines in my soul, that's what I love when I love you, my God. This is what I would call Augustine's ambivalence. And if I were smart enough, I would write a whole history of Christian liturgy called The Aftermath of Augustine's Ambivalence. On the one hand, no. I don't want to be carried away by the senses. The body's beauty, time's rhythm, light's brightness. On the other hand, if I have any language at all, O God, it will be very much like the language of light and sense and smell and touch and food and fragrance. And there we have it. This, oh yes. That's what I call Augustine's ambivalence. And I think all of you now, deep into your ministries, whether you're musicians or pastors or whatever it is that you do, you understand this. Augustine also tells us when he was with Ambrose, his great teacher in Milan, early on in the 4th century, that he wept when he heard the psalms sung so beautifully. This morning, I mean, the way you chant those psalms, I don't care what your tradition is. You know, I sometimes get with Presbyterians and Baptists and pre-churchers and Methodists, and they say, we shan't chant. But the way the psalms you do here, this chant, it's powerful, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's very powerful. So the very sound of prayer is itself a music that worships. It's like hearing someone read the scripture not long ago. A young girl, 12 years old, gets up and reads Ephesians 4. We all love Ephesians 4. And here she is, trembling on the edge of adolescence and all that means in our culture, reading to us in this wonderful, simple, unvibratoed soprano voice. We are to grow up into every way into him who is the head, speaking the truth in love. I tell you, dear friends, her voice, that sound of her reading, changed my sense of Ephesians 4. You know this. I see it already. I see your polite Caucasian amens. I'm from Atlanta, so folks, you know, I've been in Ebenezer and other places. So I want to prompt you into recollection of how Augustine's ambivalence is so important to us. Not so much his ambivalence, but it's that and yet part. It's the and yet. The sound of that 12-year-old's voice and that text, that occasion. And I won't be able to go home again because I don't know when I will be hearing it read again, but she will be present in my hearing, and I will see her, and I will hear that voice and all that that means. That's a concrete example of something you have in your repertoires as leaders of worship, as people who form a community of faith over time. The way the sound and the sight and the touch and the smell. I was thinking last night, the privilege, as many of you have, of serving Eucharist. Everything is in the hands and the faces. Palsied hands, rough hands, strong hands, manicured hands, and last night, baby hands. Stretching out. And I think of the hands as the metaphor of God, God's gift to us. The way now in which, for me, and I think for many of you too, those hands, in all of their variety, bespeak a humanity stretching out for the grace of God. And so I think of the hands as, I would add this to Augustine's Enviat, you know, how do I love you? I love you with my hands. And then this morning, of course, we use our hands and stretch them out. One so fascinating, I'm not going to dwell on Augustine much longer, although we can always learn from him, ancient and future. What's so striking to me here, if you know anything at all about the early rites of baptism, of initiation, those 4th century rites that were done in Milan that he obviously experienced, Augustine himself, they were filled with this. In fact, I would claim that in Augustine's attempt to express what it is to love God, he has used the images from those baptismal rites. Listen again. Something like light, sound, smell, food, the voice, the food, the fragrance, the embrace. That sounds like stuff that was going on in those rites of initiation to me. Manna and honey given to the newly baptized, the embrace, the new clothing, the light. Some of us have recovered in our traditions at baptism and at initiation and the various rites of renewal, some of those very sensual signs. Some of us are still a little shy. We're on the other side of it. I think Daryl was saying this morning, some of our traditions have emphasized more than others the symbol. But Augustine also said, the Spirit, the Word comes to the sign. The Word comes to the sign and you have a sign. So I start with St. Augustine, our brother, who speaks, I think, a language that we understand. And I would invite you to go back to the Confessions. And he does this fascinating stuff, not just with this, but with time and with the body and with all of the ranges of the eye and the ear. So, also let me start with a prayer that we'll examine in session 7. I would like to anticipate a little bit of what we'll hear there. This is a new Eucharistic prayer by Gail Ramshaw. Some of you who are Lutherans know that Gail, we had a couple of Lutherans on the table here. Gail Ramshaw and Susan Briel, they're these fabulous women text writers coming along. Also hymn text writers, which we'll examine in our sessions tomorrow. But here is a prayer that she has composed at the table. And I thought I would just give you some sense of this prayer composed with images that I think are extraordinarily sense-oriented. And this is all by way of introducing our verbal, nonverbal relationship, which is our preoccupation this morning. There is the opening dialogue, God be with you, etc., etc. Then there's the Holy One, Holy Three, and there's the Sanctus, and so on. And right after the Sanctus, this is the way the prayer goes. Holy God, Holy One, Holy Three, you beyond the galaxies, you under the oceans, you inside the leaves, you pouring down rain, you opening the flowers, you feeding the insects, you giving us your image, you carrying us through the waters, you holding us in the night, your smile on Sarah and Abraham, your hand with Moses and Miriam, your words through Deborah and Isaiah, living as Jesus amongst us, healing, teaching, dying, rising, inviting us all to your feast. Fresh language, doing what the ancient prayer signifies. And so I'm always looking for a way of opening the senses. St. Benedict says in the rule, I'm an oblate of St. John's Abbey in Minnesota, St. Benedict says, open, attend with the ears of your heart, listen. We could kind of do an E.E. Cummings, couldn't we? We could see, now is the eye of my eye open, and the ear of my ear open. So this prayer, and others like it, and new texts that are being written, some of which we will sing, have this wonderful way of using the senses to open us up to this lavish love of God. And some of our congregations are starved for that, which too, once they meet, they will understand what it is that God does in creation and redemption and the promise. So we'll come back to these things, but I would want to use those as touchstones. Let's take a look at this handout. This would be projected on the screen, but you have it here. I just simply gave this to you in the old-fashioned way. And I want to start with three definitions. No one definition of Christian worship is possible. That will exhaust it. So I'm going to give you three and have you think threeness, think them together. The first is the classic one that you all know probably. The glorification of God and the sanctification of all that is human. And a new generation is coming along and saying, not just all that is human, all that is creaturely. Sanctification, the rendering holy. And in the very act of adoring the Creator of all, the Redeemer of all, suddenly it opens up a space for understanding what holiness is. And so I would suggest then that this first definition is right at the center. The simultaneity of glorifying God, adoring God, praising God, and having conferred upon those who gather this quality of life we call holiness. This afternoon we're going to look at affections, we're going to look at emotions, and one of the great rare emotions is awe and wonder at the holy, the encounter with the otherness of God that is so intimately ours. So that would be the first definition. Second would be a more functional definition that my dear colleague Jim White, of blessed memory, once gave. I've just added a few little festoons to it. The best definition is just speaking and touching in God's name. So I've added this. Gathering around the book, the pot, and the table to receive the grace of God, to speak and touch in God's name. That's a more, you know, to use a sophisticated term, more phenomenological. It sort of starts with the phenomena of speaking and touching. Now, speaking requires listening, doesn't it? So you'd have to expand this. Before you speak, you must listen. Before we speak to God, we must hear. And that's a whole domain. How do we get people to hear? How do you get people to listen? The activity of attending, of listening, of being attuned to what is being said. And then, of course, touching is not just simply physical touching. It also means drawing close to one another, being in proximity, sharing life. Koinonia, Acts 2:4, you know, that early description we have of those four patterns there in Acts 2:42 following. Being tangent with one another. Touching means laughing with those who laugh, rejoicing with those who rejoice, weeping with those who weep. All of that seems to me to be part of what we would want to include in any definition of the gathered community in worship. And then the third is a more Christological one. Let's think of worship as the gathered community, as the ongoing prayer and word and action of Jesus Christ in and through his body in the world. In other words, it's his liturgy before it's ours, and will be his long after we are no longer in the physical choir, but in the metaphysical choir, you might say, in the communion of saints. But let me add one thing that I don't have here. Animated by his breath, animated by the Spirit of God. So we think of it then, think of baptism as joining Jesus' liturgy. Ah, so it's not just about the gathering in the four walls, is it? If we are joining his ongoing prayer, his ongoing word, his ongoing act or deed, then what we do in the four walls that we call liturgy is connected with what he is about in the whole cosmos, and all permeated and animated, made alive by Spirit. Okay, see the three definitions? Now, you can do a lot with these things, and I think we need all three. We need a formal definition that starts with the God orientation, especially in a culture that's been set on entertaining itself to death. You know, Holston's old book, Entertaining Ourselves to Death. This reorientation to God. Now, God opens up many and wondrous and surprising things, some of which give us great pleasure and delight. So, I'm not going to play the old sourpuss and say, you know, entertainment is out. But I do think that glorifying God is not the same as being entertained. Let me give it to you verbally. Sometimes it's better just hear it in a voice, face to face. Three great heresies that the church perpetrates. One is, we do worship for people. We put it on. It's a heresy. It's the people. Second is, we do worship to people. Manipulation. And third is, we don't prepare people. We don't prepare the church to worship. So those doing worship for people, putting it on for people, doing it to them, like a Gatling gun. You know, some liturgies are like Gatling guns. You want to quote Shakespeare. Words, 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 my Lord. Yeah. Or, my prayers ascend above, my thoughts remain below. And when we fire worship at people, and then especially the third one, when we don't give them a chance to understand what they're entering into. Old word, catechesis, formation, new word. Just simply preparing people to enter into this glorification of God. And this has everything to do with people seeking, people finding an idiom to express their seeking for transcendence, for something beyond. What Tallulah Bankhead, the great Southern theologian, you know, once said, you know, my dear, there's much less here than meets the eye. And what do we want to say? Oh, what eye has not seen, nor has ear yet heard, that's prepared. So this third heresy is that oftentimes we neglect the formation of the assembly itself. And, you know, I don't know how it is with you, and I hope you're different, and you probably are, but I go into many churches where there's never been a decent course. There's never been a decent Sunday school class. There's never been any kind of formation in ministry, the basic things. And so, I mean, sometimes I think if occasionally read to our church, you know, Justin Martyr's apology, people would begin to understand what we do more. So those three things. Now, what I'm going to do now is open up a conversation with you around these things that I've got in bold type here. So one approach, and it's only one approach, would be to ask the question, what is the relationship between the words, the texts, the verbal, which we specialize in, and the nonverbal? And so I've got these bold-faced categories for us to think with as well as about. So let me just put these out here, and then what I want to do is take each in turn and invite you to give us examples of where these things have become real for people, for you maybe to begin with, but for your communities. Time. Time as a nonverbal language, or if you want, you could use a symbolic language. Now, the crazy thing about time, did you notice this is in Augustine's quote? Not time's rhythm, he says. And yet it's precisely time's rhythm that gives people access to God. The passages you go through, birth and suffering and death and children growing up, getting their driver's license, you know, going away, times when you first experience your own mortality. This is time's rhythm in life. Now, the church also has a way of keeping time. Now, my favorite definition of the so-called church year or liturgical calendar is keeping time with Jesus. Because you can't say it all at once. Some of us have tried sermons in which we've tried to say it. But I think there's a great wisdom in the fact that we have to move through cycles of time in order to remember Jesus adequately. I'm sure you've got this in courses when you were here. But it's a way of thinking of the cycles of the week, the cycles of the year, and the most forgetful one in our culture, don't you think, the cycle of the day? That ancient notion of arising in the morning as a sign of resurrection, having been kept through the night, but also going down to sleep, which is a metaphor of death. George Herbert had this, there were poets, our poets knew this rhythm of day and night until we changed night into day. Let me give you a little story from my childhood. This may ring some chimes with you. I loved the night sky. I grew up in a town where night was still night. It wasn't so much diffused light. And there was a little farming community around the edges of the town. And I loved to crawl out on the edges of a window box in my aunt's house who raised me. I'm sure she never knew that I was out there. But that's another story. What we get away with. Our secret places. But I would, especially on clear nights, crawl out there and look at the Milky Way. Sort of be sort of stunned by it. Well, I had a fifth grade teacher with the unlikely name of Miss Bork. I mean, that's a sitting duck right there for 10-year-olds. Oh, Miss Bork, full of Bork. Okay. But she did us a great thing as a teacher. At the end of each day, when we were through with all of the studies, she would either read us a story or a poem or tell us some kind of really interesting fact. And I will never forget the day that she asked the class, children, do you know what the Milky Way is?
Yes, in this book.
It stars. But when you see that, what do you see?
Well, we see stars, Miss Bork.
She said, now children, remember this. When you look at the Milky Way, you are looking through the edge of your galactic home. Now, galactic home, first of all, it's a wonderful galactic, it's like peanut butter in the mouth, it's a galactic home. It was so striking. And guess what? That night was a clear night, and I climbed out on the window box, and there it was, like it's always been. I've seen it 1,000 times before, but I'd never seen it like this. Suddenly the words came to my seeing and intensified the seeing. Just like Augustine said, the word comes to the nonverbal act of seeing, and suddenly you see more. It's that little, I know this is non-technical. I'm not here to give you metaphysical news from nowhere. I'm here to do what Dr. Johnson said so long ago. Humankind hath not so much need to be informed as to be reminded. We in our glut of data and information need to be reminded of some of these most elemental things. So Miss Bork gave us this wonderful way of redescribing what we had seen before and now seeing it differently. I hope there's already some resonance in what you're thinking. So I think of time then. We live through it. We're always in the stream of time. Unless there's a way of stepping out of the stream and having a story about the time through which we live, then time is just one damn thing after that. Let me put it another way. This is a pastoral way to put it. Show me a family that doesn't keep its birthdays, its anniversaries, its death days, or mark significant passages, and I'll show you a dysfunctional family. Right? Am I right on this one? So it seems to me then that the central role in the church's worship of anamnesis, or anamnesis, depending on where you first read it and who said it, that notion of calling to mind, and the Hebrew term behind this is zikran, of course, Z-K-R, you know, the notion of remembering, call to remembrance, that the church says it's going to take time to understand what has been given to you and where you are to live and how you are to live. So the rhythms of the day, the rhythm of the week around the Sunday gathering, and the rhythm of the year in which the story of God in all of creation but mediated through Christ is told, is unfolded, sanctifies time. Makes it holy, makes it bear something other than one damn thing after another. So the church has an enormous gift to give to people's lives who are sometimes so dysfunctional. But you guys know, you know this, when it comes to marking a specific time, a tragic time or a joyful time, death, or weddings, or baptisms, you know there's a kind of expectation and intensification of people's awareness. So I would just remind us that there is this nonverbal language of time which connects with the deepest things in our mortal frame. We are very temporal. P.S. footnote. Footnotes are often over here. The footnote is that music is so temporal. And why is it that music can sometimes, even the music of ourselves, the rhythms of our lives, why is it that music can take you places that you didn't think you could go? Why is it that when you can't sing because of your grief, and you hear a congregation around you singing for all the saints, they sing with you and for you. That music captures something of our temporality, and yet the music passes, doesn't it? And isn't this Jeremy Begbie has written some really nice things on this, on time and music. I'll give you a little bibliography at the end, in which only sometimes at the end of the music do you understand all that's gone on in the music. That's a metaphor for life. We wouldn't grasp it all until the whole melody is played, the whole harmonic structure unfolds. So I think the language of time is very closely connected with the language of music. And maybe it's like one of our early teachers said, the whole of one's Christian life should be like one long melody played to God. One thing that we don't understand until the whole song is said. I'm talking too much. Space. Obviously, we could talk about the language of space and how we dwell in different spaces, and specific times and places that provide a kind of visual theology. Now, let me give you another story. This is the story with me sitting on a hard Methodist church bench with my grandmother and noticing, I remember, always there was one stained glass window. It was not your Tiffany window. Sort of not so hot as a work of art, but it was over there, and it was the image of Jesus with the lamb around his shoulder, right? Mm-hmm. Are you there with me? Mm-hmm. You've seen that. Well, I was always sort of taken by this. When the sermons were long and so on, I would always look up there as well. Finally, one day I asked my grandma, I said, Jesus cares for the lamb. But Grammy, I said, what's the lamb's name? And as only a wise grandmother could say, she said, that's you. That's your name. The name of the lamb is Don. Talk about visual theology. Mm-hmm. There's another one of those things where a word, a short word, whispered in church, suddenly created for me a living icon, mm-hmm. a Christological icon that I will carry with me to the end of my days. Mm-hmm. Thank you, grandmother, for that. Space, then, is connected with sight, isn't it? What we see and what we hear. So there's another whole language of sight. And I think one of the things we want to keep asking ourselves is, what's the relationship between the visible and the invisible? What's the relationship between what we see and what can't be seen? And that is why we all love those passages about what eye has not seen nor ear heard has been promised. Sound, the same thing. How many of you remember the voice of a grandparent or perhaps of someone in a church you grew up in? I remember a tenor voice, especially. Ralph Barton was his name. And I remember, I can still hear him singing Jesu Bambino once a year. No. I hope you're thinking right now, isn't that amazing that you can remember the sound of a voice? We lost our youngest daughter 8 years ago, unexpectedly. There are times when I hear her voice or someone even closely resembling that. This thing in our life, this nonverbal language of sound and sight that Augustine is talking about. But then there is also a language, a nonverbal language of ways of doing things. Habits in which a church will do certain things. A tradition of performance, you might even say. Don't worry about the word performance here. I'm just meaning that we use forms, and through the forms, something gets enacted. You know, ways of doing communion or baptism. And then the ways sometimes where it takes a surprise and a shock in order for us to understand the form we already have been using. Here's an example. I was in a baptismal service. in a Methodist church, this turned out to be. And, you know, it was finally after they had begun to change the form and have the sponsors and the family process down to the font. And we didn't used to do that, but now they did. Well, the baby in arms was to be baptized, being carried by the mother and the father. But the 5-year-old brother of the younger sister was in the hands of the grandparents, and they're all coming down the central aisle, until the 5-year-old spots the associate pastor, whom he has this thing, this great friendship, and he breaks free of his grandparents' hold. Then there's a kind of NFL slow motion video. Can you see it? Here's he breaks free, and the grandparents are going. And the kid's going like this, and the congregation is going like this, and he gets to within about 12 feet of the associate pastor and leaps like Carl Lewis in a long jump. And so, another slow motion, the kid's going like this, like a Picasso painting or something. And the congregation is going, and he leaps into the arms of the associate pastor, and it breaks everything open. Mm-hmm. Suddenly the embrace, the receiving of this child was a metaphor for what was going on in baptism. Christ was receiving this child. So sometimes the traditions we have need to be broken open, don't they? And sometimes, thank God, God sends surprises like that. But other times it's a matter of how the word we preach or pray or sing actually opens up what we're doing. And therein is, of course, the good liturgical work of planning well, of finding the right music at the right time. I'm talking to the musicians, number two, and the pastors, that will break open the nonverbal languages of the gestures. Now, there's nothing more important in church than this gesture of open arms, open door, large and generous symbols that can be seen and heard and tasted. You know, tradition, what we use now, we used the wafers last night, and I couldn't help remember the old Catholic joke, you know, the old Catholic joke. It's more of a miracle to believe that it's bread than to believe that it's the body of Christ. But nonetheless, a simple saltine cracker and a little cup of Welch's on a camping trip or in a parlor someplace or an unexpected celebration suddenly breaks it open too, doesn't it? And then we can go back to our lovely chalices. Right ways of doing these things. We need these refreshments to break open the nonverbal, the gestural part of our work. Scripture itself is, I would call it, this is an interesting way, in a way, to think of the scripture as a nonverbal presence. Calvin had it right. The word is an audible sacrament. The word is an audible sacrament. And the sacrament is a visible, palpable word. Calvin was really good at that. I mean, he gets it from somewhere else, like Jesus. But Augustine's in there too. Well, all of these things are here. And now what I'd like to do here is simply open up for you. I want you to begin to share examples like I've tried to prompt in you, because all of this can be considered under the notion of ritual signs and actions. One last story, because a lot of you have raised children, and you know this story. When you raise your children, you want them to be grateful, and you want them to be thankful, and so you tell them early on, say thank you, right? I mean, I don't know what moral nitwit invented the fact, oh, well, I'm not going to give them any formation. When they grow up, they'll grow into this naturally. That was a kind of moral nitwit sort of invented that. So we had four daughters, and we taught them to say thank you, and they would, and each came to a certain stage in their life when the same thing happened. For them, it was an oppression. They would stand
with their feet at a 45-degree angle, grimace, look at the floor, and say, "Thank you." You know this story? Do you know this story? Thank you, Mrs. Smith. In that one fine day, when you least expected it, into your study, on your way home from work, into the kitchen, the child comes and says, "Thank you, Mom. Thank you, Daddy." That language now becomes gesture, now becomes an opening. The world has changed for the child. Now there are givers and gifts and exchanges and something like we call a grateful heart is being born here. The ability to see the world differently because you have these words that are more than words. And maybe that's the most important thing of all, is that when those words become more than words and enter into the ritual itself, then we should not worry anymore about it. I'm not going to get caught with dead ritual. I preached in Hennepin United Methodist Church, big flagship church up in Minneapolis not long ago, a couple years ago, and a guy came up to me afterwards. I could see he was heading toward me. He said, "Why do you people, you're always talking about the old stuff, when the Bible's full of old history, and then you always do this ritual stuff, this communion stuff." And that stopped me for a minute. I mean, I wanted to know something more, what's behind all this, this death fear of dead ritual and old stuff. Well, I just began to talk with him a little bit. We got into a conversation about something else. And then, sitting at lunch, he said, "You know, I'm a 32nd degree Mason." Now, maybe that hasn't registered yet. In order to be a 32nd degree Mason, you have to know ritual backwards and forwards, upside down, in the basement of the Masonic Lodge. You gotta have it before breakfast, even. So, can you believe six things before breakfast?
No.
Anyway, so I was really curious about this guy who came at me with such fierceness. Well, it turns out it wasn't quite what it seemed. It wasn't an objection against ritual because he had this in his life. He's going to be buried in an apron. Masonic symbol on it. It was because he got burned in church early on and has never recovered. He connected somehow church ritual with judgment and emptiness and fakery and hypocrite and so on. I didn't get all the way down the line with him in that pastoral conversation, but I got enough of a whiff of how he had been burned about this, and he couldn't make the transfer. He could do it in spades, diamonds, hearts, and clubs in the basement of the Masonic Lodge. But the church... So that leads us to another whole discussion about why people resist certain kinds of interaction. But I do go back to the family question. What rituals does a family keep and why? And why does Grandmother Murty's dessert have to be always in the same place at holidays? With the same marshmallows. Well, not, I mean, they're new marshmallows. Think about that now. You think about that. And homecomings. Homecomings are still alive in my part of the country when you get outside the metropolitan area. And homecomings are these enormously powerful memory ritual occasions, and especially when we go out in the cemetery. So, okay. Well, I think you got my general point, and I have gone on a little too long, but that's what I wanted to open up in these first two sessions, that there's this enormous range of play between the words and the nonverbal patterns, and they're much larger than when we first start thinking about them. That's why I would want to include the language of time, the language of space, the language of sound and sight, the language of ritual gesture, the language of the scriptures themselves being read as ritual action, and then include them, finally, as I say at the end here, a
the life passages that people are bringing. And what is it about Christian worship that connects so deeply with the deepest needs we have to live in time and space, this mortal life, and begin to make sense of it in light of who God is? And sometimes I think the problem is that the range of our humanity has not been yet touched and opened by the very resources the church has. And I'm not talking high church versus low. I'm not talking about smells and bells versus plain Mennonite. Although the Mennonites sing in four parts and put Catholics to shame. But that's another question. Now, what I want to do is open up just in an informal way here before we take the first break. Because when we come back in the second part, I'm going to be using some materials, some images that will be illustrative material. So I'd love to have anyone, if I've touched on anything that reminds you, that prompts you about this deep aspect of our work.
Your statement about, you know, a family that doesn't keep birthdays and anniversaries, and so challenges me as someone from more of a free church tradition, and like the church, the course here on the Christian Year kind of ruined me. You know, that's a word you hear around here a lot.
Yeah,
we've been run, but it's been a challenge for me and my church to start helping our church celebrate some of the great events of Christ's life
and feasts and seasons.
And the battle is, you know, between that and the civil calendar, and it seems to me to be more of a generational thing. Woe be to me if we don't recognize veterans on Veterans Day. And it seems to be more, I mean, we still have World War II veterans in our church, and we have Vietnam veterans, we have Desert Storm veterans. It seems to me it's the most important for that senior adult generation and the things of the civil calendars. And it seems to me that our younger generations, middle age, seem to be more open to the idea that Pentecost was a big deal. We should celebrate once a year, you know. I see some hope on the horizon, but I'm just wondering if anybody else, especially from a free church tradition, kind of finds the same thing generationally or...
I think some of that is true. I'm also in a free church tradition. I've used the civil calendar to help explain why we need these celebrations, and the biggest example I've used has come from my own life. I turned 16 in India on King Missions, and we started work on our church that we were building that day on July 4th, and we have a picture of the whole group, and it says July 4th, 1977 on it, and I'm sure everybody wondered why in the world we did that, but to us it was the strangest feeling not to be having barbecue, going to parades, doing the 4th of July stuff, because that's part of what marks our culture. And so I've used that in talking to the church, and saying, just as being American, we expected to do something on the 4th of July, and it didn't, and it was weird, as the church, these are the holidays that mark our culture. And they've been able to understand that.
Yeah, I think this is one of the big places of dissonance for many people, and I think that way in which the rhythms of our life in the social order, in a particular culture, sometimes clash, but other times that I think they're opportunities. I think of certain seasons of the year where we could make the connection, not just with Veterans Day, and so on, with this larger question of sacrifice in time of war, and what is the divine attitude toward this question? So I think those two, you're introducing that question, we might want to come back to that. But I think some of us feel that the opposite problem would be in a really, I'm just going to pick on this tradition, but really, really, really high Anglicanism, a higher Anglo-Catholicism that leaves no room for the connection between the liturgical year and those rituals and these other things. Frankly, when we come to the first Sunday of Advent, I'm suddenly reminded of so much suffering. The cry of the prophets. And when we turn and finally sing, at least in the traditions I'm familiar with, something like, oh come Emmanuel. I mean, that might not be everyone's cup of tea, but there would be some other equivalent to that. Suddenly I feel reminded that this world's suffering. So much of it that I ignore, I push off because it's too much to bear, has been born, has been cried out from. So I think there are linkages. That would be the thing that we need, is a kind of an imagination that would make the connections and finding those things are possible. Not always possible. Boy Scout Sunday, well, and yet isn't Boy Scout Sunday going to be more poignant because of that camp in Iowa now? We are not going to think of Boy Scout Sunday merely as, you know, another gesture in the direction of the young people. We saw the heroism. We've heard the heroism now. And so the other thing is, like old Karl Barth said, you know, well, I'll keep the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. Only now for us it's internet, TV, and Facebook, and YouTube, and God knows what. It's a little overwhelming. So I think the linkage that you two have opened up for us is a really important one when we talk about the language. Are there other things that came to your mind this week?
I would agree with Bill. Our congregation grew from a charismatic background into a Reformed Presbyterian background and on into more liturgical stylings. Mm-hmm. But part of that growth did take a great amount of time with very simple and gentle progression, introduction of new elements of the church here. Christmas and Easter, always on the calendar. Let's expand just a little bit on the meaning of Christmas, what comes before Christmas. Well, that began to work, and people over the last 8 to 10 years within the congregation have truly begun to walk in real time, not in church pageant time, with Jesus Christ and with the world and that thing. Also, another thing that rang true with us was the connect between Mother's Day, this last Pentecost, and rebirth of the Spirit. And we were able to make a number of analogies of the Spirit brooding over the waters at creation, Noah being delivered through water, being born of water and Spirit. Yeah. And it became very alive and beautiful for our congregation. And that was a fluke. We just kind of praised God for it.
But there it is.
That's awesome.
You know, it's in the imaginative repertoire. I mean, that sometimes I think that we sell the congregation short. We think what's in their repertoire. I mean, the analogy is, of course, we only sing these 14 hymns, you know, and so on. Well, how does the repertoire ever get expanded except sometimes it's the great surprise, sometimes it's the connection that you make. How about All Saints Day, and how about the other calendar that many of us don't have immediately, the sanctoral cycle, the temporal cycles we're talking about, Advent, Christmas, Lent, tra-la-la. Have any of you had any experiences with a kind of Protestant recovery of the sanctuary? Is that a little alien to us? And yet, our churches are filled with the remembrances of saints. And Glenn Hinson has been one of my heroes and one of my, those of you in the Baptist tradition, Glenn is just one of the great, great souls. And he and I are both on the staff of Weavings. We're editors of Weavings Journal and so on. And his stories, coming out of Baptist traditions, about the implicit sanctuary cycle that the church had in remembering those folks. I've got one story from an All Saints celebration that I think I'll never forget. Just to prompt you. We we celebrate All Saints by, and this is for the musicians too, we decided to really go for this one, so we used Fauré's Requiem as the musical structure of the service. By the way, don't do it with Verdi or Berlioz or even the German Rick. Do it with Fauré, who's it's so accessible there. Well, we named, for the first time, we named those who had died during the year with a simple ringing of a bell bowl, the tone and the name. And in the sacristy afterwards, a woman came in, tears running down her cheeks. She said, I finally gave him over. Mm-hmm. I don't need to tell you folks, you know what she meant. She said, finally, I've been grieving over the loss of my husband for these years, and this occasion, I knew, she said, it was the prayer and the music and the congregation, and the intensity of that. She said, I give him over to the Lord and the communion of sins.
In our general conference in my denomination, we meet every other year. One of the highlights is the memorial service for pastors and pastors' wives that have died in those past 2 years. In 1999, we were in San Diego, California. That's where our general conference was, and because it was San Diego, lots of people went and played rather than went to the general conference. When it came to the memorial service, that's just the way it was, I'm sorry.
So you were one of those guys.
No, I went to the general conference. When it came to the memorial service, of the committee of three, two were playing. And the one that was there didn't want to read all of the names.
Oh, dear.
And so he simply said there were X amount of people who died this year, X amount of pastors, X amount of pastors' wives. We were horrified. And one woman, bless her heart, just said, could I hear the name of my friend read? You know, after we were stunned, we were just like, and I just said, I hope I don't die in a year when we're in San Diego. You know, and she just said, could I please hear at least the name of my friend?
And did someone produce the name?
Then finally he read them all. This man read them all. But usually it's the name plus a short biography of where he or she served. And, you know, but this was just, you know, 13.
17 of us died.
Yeah. So,
our need, see, this is beautiful, and we're going to take a break now because I see the angel of mercy has come in. These are all right on target. You know, I was told that you would be a great bunch, and now I know we're launched. It's this kind of thing that will prompt us into this deeper meaning, not only taking us back into those first three definitions of what Christian liturgy is, but these unlocking the power of these nonverbal languages. And of course, the secret is they aren't nonverbal without something verbal. And so let me end this session by simply saying, if you look at the liturgy of Jesus, what he said and did, see, there's the secret. The word and the sacrament are already involved in his saying and doing. And sometimes his words were healing, and sometimes his gestures were healing. So word and sacrament belong to our fundamental perception of the Christological center of our faith. So Jesus, and that's why Skilabex, this is a Dutch name, you know, said that Jesus was the primordial sacrament of God. That word and sacrament are not two sort of different realities. We have an unhappy history, of course, of that. But we're overcoming it, and this institute is one of those places where it is being overcome. So all these nonverbal languages are animated by the principal notion of what Jesus says and does. And so I'll end with a great formula that I once learned and I keep repeating because it's so good. What Jesus said and did, he now wishes to say and do right here in River City. And we'll say and do until the kingdom of God comes in fullness. Isn't that great? So you have this sense of, if we could remember and enact as profoundly as our human frailty would allow us, Sunday by Sunday, what he said. And he's doing this now. And we got to build up the sense that when we come to church, that's what he wishes. He wishes to say and do what he did. And we'll say and do until the rule and reign of God comes in the fullness. If we believe that, one-tenth of it, one-hundredth of it, it would change everything. But it cashes out in these very specific, determinate ways in which we work with people with this relationship between the verbal and the nonverbal. Yeah, you get the last word here before we take a little break.
Thank you. Kierkegaard's moment. Are we ever going to, or is it inappropriate to even think of it? We're talking about ancient future. Eucharist reminds us that we're the proliptic community, you know, and on and on.
Yeah.
Is it just that we're not able to be in the moment? Is it inappropriate for us to be in the moment? Is it impossible for us?
Let that hang. that's kind of like up there. East of Eden? We're all east of Eden. And as T.S. Eliot once said, humankind can't stand that much reality. You know? Why? And then once in a while, it's like Flannery O'Connor says, it's as clear as a sock in the jaw. She said. Flannery O'Connor. Do you know any of her short stories and stuff? Great theologian. Raised peacocks in Georgia. I don't know. Let's let the question hang and keep coming back at it. I mean, we all know this pastorally, what keeps people from being present to the everlasting. Sylvia Dunstan's great hymn, Christus Paradox, says, you, the everlasting instant. Speaking of Christ, you, the everlasting one. I think it's straight Kierkegaard. But let's let your question, why, what keeps us? And we start a little late, so we're going to take a break for 15 minutes, like we should, like God told us to.